I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The country is in the throes of a gun violence epidemic. Here in Philadelphia, there have been more than 500 homicides this year, and most of those killings were committed by people using guns. This is true in many other parts of the country. A 15-year-old shot and killed four students and wounded seven others at Oxford High School in Michigan last week, making it the 29th school shooting this year. It is very easy to get a gun in the United States, and that is a result, in part, of the work of the NRA. It was founded after the Civil War to teach gun safety and supported things like waiting periods and bans on sawed-off shotguns and silencers. Today, it fights every form of gun regulation. Our guest Tim Mack has been investigating the NRA for the last 4 years, and he found an organization in disarray with infighting and chaotic management under the leadership of CEO Wayne LaPierre. It is facing lawsuits alleging corruption and financial mismanagement. Mack got secret recordings of the NRA as it grappled with responding to the Columbine High School massacre back in 1999, and we will play excerpts. Tim Mack is investigative correspondent for NPR. His book is titled Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, when I think about the NRA, certainly until the last couple of years, I think of this powerhouse organization that really critics crossed at their own peril. They literally called the shots when it came to gun legislation, punished perceived enemies, rewarded friends. But looking at the subtitle to your book, are we witnessing the end or certainly the downfall of the NRA?
Well, the NRA is right now, you did a great job of summing it up. But here's how I would describe it. It's really facing the most serious mortal threat that it's ever faced in more than 150 years. You have revolt among some of its members, angry about corruption and misconduct inside the organization. You've got protests from its own board of directors, a series of very dire financial problems. I mean, in 2018, they almost couldn't make payroll. And then you've got the New York Attorney General's investigation and subsequent lawsuit that's seeking to dissolve the NRA completely. And that's a real possibility over the next period of time.
So it's internal and external, these threats to the organization.
That's right. I mean, the NRA has faced some of these individually in the past, but they never faced them all at once. And it really poses a threat to its very existence.
I do want to get to all that, but I do want to play some of the recordings that you got your hands on. Now, these were secret recordings. It was an NRA meeting that occurred, you know, right after the Columbine school shooting. This was back in 1999. You can hear Wayne LaPierre. You can either hear other NRA executives and lobbyists, and they're trying to figure out how to respond to the shooting and the deaths and what to do because, strangely, weirdly, they're about to have a convention, a conference in Denver, which is just maybe 30 miles or so from where Columbine is. Anything that we need to know about how you got these tapes? I know, that's probably secret material, but nonetheless.
Well, the tapes were recorded by a participant on the call. And what we did in order to report out this tape was we reached out to everyone who was on the call that was on the audio that we played, and we of course reached out to the NRA also for a response.
And what was their response to your response?
Well, they said that the audio was part of a hit piece, and that they also criticized kind of bringing up Columbine again 20 years after the incident. That was the gist of the response.
And what we're going to hear, and I'll have you walk us through some of these tapes, is they're trying to figure out how to respond to this massacre at Columbine High School, correct?
That's right. This is the day after it all happened. And to put it a little bit more in context, by coincidence, the NRA had planned its most important event, the annual convention, in Denver, just miles away from the site of the tragedy, and just a week and a half after the shooting occurred. So they're in a serious crisis, and they need to figure out what to do about this meeting that they've already spent thousands and thousands of dollars on.
Well, let's go through some of these tapes, and I'll just set them up. We'll listen, and then, Tim, you can flesh them out for us. This is NRA lobbyist Jim Baker, and explaining his concern with the optics, as you mentioned, of holding a gun convention so soon after the shooting at Columbine.
this is the same concern, obviously, that everybody has, is that at the same period where they're going to be burying these children, we're going to be having media within 10 miles of our convention center, the world's media, trying to run through the exhibit hall looking at kids fondling firearms, which is going to be a horrible, horrible, horrible juxtaposition.
I mean, clearly, Tim, he's worried about the optics, right?
Yeah, and this is one of those things where an interesting point to be made is they're not concerned about, hey, how do we prevent these sorts of events from happening in the future? The big push here in this conversation, and this is 2.5 hours worth of tapes, the big push in this conversation is how do we ensure that we don't get public relations blowback? How do we avoid being seen to be responsible or culpable in any way?
Well, that leads us to our second tape, and this is, again, NRA official. How do you say, is it Kanye? Kanye Robinson?
Kane Robinson.
Kane Robinson and others are talking about whether they should contribute money to the victims. Let's give that a listen.
Is there something concrete that we can offer, not because guns are responsible, but because we care about these people? Is there anything, does that look crass or...
like a victims fund? Or
we create a victim fund and we give the victim $1 million or something like that. Does that look bad or does it look...
Well, I mean, that can be twisted, too. I mean, why are you giving money? You feel responsible?
No, well, you're true. It can be twisted, but we feel sympathetic and respectful.
So they're worried about responsibility, right, Tim?
Well, yeah, and this is what's so interesting about these tapes, right, is that the NRA is really debating in real time what their playbook is going to be for the mass shootings to come in the years to come. And Columbine is such a landmark in that it opened up in many ways this era where these school shootings become much more common than they had been in the past. And so what the tapes show is they show the NRA kind of grappling with a softer tone, with more responsibility, canceling their convention maybe, or even setting up this victims fund to put money towards, you know, helping the community. But what's interesting is kind of how what they end up doing.
Indeed. Let me play one more, and this is, or actually several more, but this is Jim Land, Tony Makris. Makris, is that correct?
That's Makris. Tony Makris.
Yeah, and they're talking about, again, this risk of being too apologetic. Let's give that a listen.
I got to tell you, we got to think this thing through, because if we duck tail and run, we're going to be accepting responsibility for what happened out there.
That's one very good argument, Jim. On the other side, if you don't appear to be deferential in honoring the dead, you end up being a tremendous head who wouldn't tuck tail and run, you know? So it's a double-edged sword.
Oh, it's so chilling.
Well, this is the real tension in the organization and what they have to do after Columbine. They're considering, like I was saying, this softer approach, you know, even potentially an apology or something, some apologetic gestures. But what they end up doing is they end up, while they scale back some of their festivities and what's called an exhibit hall, you know, where guns are displayed and ammunition and accessories are displayed, they do eventually go through with some version of the convention.
Let me play another, and this is former NRA president. This is Marion Hammer, and she has some concerns about how the media will cover this NRA convention if it's kind of stripped down and it's just NRA members. Let's give that a listen.
If you pull down the exhibit hall, that's not going to leave anything for the media except the members' meeting, and you're going to have the wackos with all kinds of crazy resolutions, with all kinds of dressing like a bunch of hillbillies and idiots, and it's gonna be the worst thing you can imagine.
And here's the president of the NRA, Marion Hammer, talking about the members as wackos.
Well, this is a remarkable part of the tape, because it shows you know, there's the kind of actual what's said. But that Marion Hammer is calling some of the NRA's members hillbillies and idiots. But But there's also this, I don't know if you heard that, that kind of knowing laugh in the background, right?
Yes.
Hey, this is not the first time they've discussed it. This is kind of their inside joke, that NRA officials view a significant portion of their own membership to be, you know, for lack of a better word, crazy. And this is something that's really obviously upset a lot of NRA members. The NRA is formed as this kind of grassroots organization, right? So the members meeting that they have every year is one where most any member can go give a speech, ask a question of the executive, propose resolutions to change NRA policy, and so on and so forth. It's really a core part of the NRA as an organization, but when you kind of pull the curtain back and you look inside the highest echelons of the NRA, what you see is some disparagement of the very membership that makes the NRA work and makes the NRA powerful to begin with.
Indeed. Hillbillies, fruitcakes, nuts, and idiotic. Those were some of the descriptions coming from leadership of their own membership. Let me play one more clip, and this is the convention that was held May 1999 in Denver. Then-President Charlton Heston delivered a message about how the group had a stance on mass shootings.
Why us? Because their story needs a villain. They want us to play the heavy in their drama of packaged grief, to provide riveting programming to run between commercials for cars and cat food. The dirty secret of this day and age is that political gain and media ratings all too often bloom on fresh graves.
And that is actually Charlton Heston blaming the media for the problems of the NRA.
Well, you know, I was saying a little bit earlier about how this call kind of shows the NRA developing in real time the playbook they're going to use. And here you see the execution, right? So what you just played was after the call at the actual convention. This is Charlton Heston executing the playbook that the NRA has kind of put together on these secret tapes. You hear him. This is one major component of the NRA strategy, which is to kind of shift the blame to the media, to say, well, it's the press's fault. And it's part of a larger strategy that the NRA has employed over the years after mass shootings, which is to say it's not the gun, it's some other kind of core reason why these mass shootings happen. It's society, it's the press, it's video games, it's violent music, it's video games, and movies, and that sort of thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Tim Mak. He's NPR's Washington investigative correspondent. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and call 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with NPR investigative correspondent Tim Mak. He's taking us inside the workings of the NRA, the corruption, the mismanagement, the power plays. And again, he's got a new book. It's titled Misfire. Let's go back 150 years, if we could. How did an organization that started after the Civil War, it taught gun safety, I mentioned in my introduction, which is from your book, supported things like waiting periods and supported bans on silencers and sawed-off shotguns. How did it become this ardent promoter of gun ownership and opposition to any form of legislation or regulation?
This is really a function of the modern NRA, right? That for the first 100 years or so, the NRA is not really considered a heavyweight in the political advocacy space. In the late 70s, actually, the NRA was considering leaving Washington, D.C. and moving to Colorado to emphasize its kind of hunting sports and gun safety elements. They were going to kind of withdraw from the political game entirely. But you remember what I was saying earlier about the NRA being a grassroots organization. Mm-hmm. It has this history of revolts. And in the late 70s, a number of prominent NRA members revolted on the floor of the convention, kicked out a bunch of executives, and shaped it to become a much more politically aggressive organization. Now, there are a number of other kind of developments over the years, but that's the turning point. And in the last 10 to 20 years, you've seen the NRA become the political powerhouse that it ultimately developed into.
In fact, you write about the – what are there, about 5 million members of the NRA? Is that pretty current?
4.9 million at the last count, but 5 million is a good round.
Good round number there. You describe the NRA, quote, as a series of warring tribes.
Yeah, there are so many different factions. I mean, when I approached the NRA, it was a black box to me, and I think for most of the public, you don't really get much of a sense of the organization looking from the outside. And when I looked in, I found so many ridiculous stories about factionalism and backstabbing, betrayal, jealousy and greed. These characters that are involved have never really been reported on. Wayne LaPierre, the head of the organization, is someone who in the public perception is this hardline gun rights advocate with this steely will to protect its members from the government who wants to pry firearms away from them. But behind the scenes, and once you talk to folks who have known him for decades and decades and decades, you find a deeply anxious, weak-willed, almost cowardly person who is easily influenced and pushed around and bullied. And people, you know, in powerful places in the NRA take advantage of him and push him around to get their bidding. And that's kind of a major part of why the NRA is in such serious financial and legal trouble nowadays.
Well, let me pick up on that. You talked to one person who said that Wayne LaPierre, as you mentioned, he's the kind of fire breather that we have seen, especially when there's been some gun-related issue, had the backbone or has the backbone of a, quote, chocolate eclair.
The book opens with the scene at Wayne LaPierre's wedding.
Yes.
And it's a remarkable scene. Wayne LaPierre doesn't want to get married. And he's been telling his friends all week. And his best man's outside and slaps a $100 bill on the dashboard of the car that they're in, a Jeep, and says, hey, I don't think you should get married either. We can drive out of here right now. But Wayne is ultimately convinced to go through with the wedding. And it starts very awkwardly and late and very obviously to everyone involved that it's been delayed for kind of unfortunate reasons. And then there's this very weird and awkward ceremony that proceeds where Wayne can't look at even make eye contact with the bride. Susan LaPierre, yeah. And it tells you something interesting about Wayne LaPierre, that he was harangued into this wedding. And much like he's been harangued and pushed and bullied by more powerful forces than him over the course of the last couple of decades, to whether that's for millions of dollars in sweetheart deals for contractors of the NRA or golden parachutes for former executives.
Well, as you write, I mean, he doesn't feel as if Wayne LaPierre is a gun enthusiast himself. Is this all about money and power? Is that what this leadership role has meant to him?
I think so, and I think in some ways he feels he's this kind of very strange human. He feels trapped almost in that position. He's not a gun guy. In fact, people who know him well describe him as almost dangerous around firearms. There's this anecdote about how he was at the range one day and someone called out his name and he swirls around and points the gun at the person calling out to him. In fact, there's a joke among people at NRA headquarters. You know, if you don't do well on your quarterly reports or whatever, you might have to, quote, go hunting with Wayne. But he's a really strange individual, deeply anxious person, filled with self-pity, Someone who withdraws when there's a mass shooting because he's worried about what it would mean for his own personal safety. The book is just filled with these kinds of stories that show what's really happening behind the scenes at the NRA.
Well, including, I mean, he is still married to Susan, the woman that he reluctantly married. And as you described, she's really the sort of powerhouse behind the man. Can we say that?
I think we can. We can kind of describe her as kind of a hidden hand at the NRA, that she gets what she wants. And she just oversees this very interesting and intriguing world of high-dollar women donors to the NRA who have given, in many cases, more than $1 million to the NRA. And there's this elite world that was so interesting to learn more about, filled with demands for loyalty and high fashion and in many ways jealousy among this clique of donors.
Well, and you also describe, I mean, you know, he's in hot water for some of these, but these lavish trips, you mentioned fashion, strange ways of managing money, just the sort of amount of money that has gone to the LaPierres for their lavish lifestyle.
Yeah, this book is about, you know, millions of dollars in NRA money. Remember, the NRA is a nonprofit. This millions of dollars of this nonprofit's money for private jets and lavish vacations to the Bahamas on a yacht and trips to Lake Como in Italy, really extravagant meals, and six figures in suits from an Italian menswear place for Wayne LaPierre. And this is something that happens during the Obama era, expands during that period, and comes to a head during the Trump era. And creates a real financial and legal problem for Wayne LaPierre and those around him.
How, though, has someone like Wayne LaPierre, as you said, someone who's highly anxious and, you know, riddled with self-doubt, how has someone who seems so ill-suited for this job been able to hold this job for so long?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, Wayne, his dream job is not to be head of the NRA. His dream job is to leave the NRA and open up an ice cream shop in Maine.
And you mean that, right? I mean, you're not just
literally.
Being, that's what he wants to do.
Literally, he wants to open up an ice cream shop in Maine. And in fact, when investigations of the NRA open up the books, they find a significant amount of money spent on ice cream.
Where does this dream come from? Do you know, Tim Mack?
I don't know. I know that he's a voracious eater of ice cream. So it may be just as simple as he really loves ice cream and it's his comfort food. But he has been saying for decades, from almost the beginning of his tenure as the head of the NRA, which starts in the early 90s, that he would really much rather be selling ice cream. And, you know, this is the funny thing. I mean, in Wayne LaPierre's malleability, in his vulnerability to bullies and stronger-willed people around him, whether that's prominent contractors to the NRA or top lobbyists at the NRA or even his wife, in that malleability, he's made himself indispensable to powerful people around him. And it's their interest to keep him there, to take the heat, to give the speeches, well, they benefit off of the NRA. Now, this is not to absolve Wayne LaPierre of responsibility, of course, but that's to explain how it is that someone like this becomes the head and stays the head of one of the nation's most powerful and controversial organizations.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Tim Mack. He's NPR's Washington investigative correspondent. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. We've been talking about the CEO and Vice President, Wayne LaPierre. And I want to make sure we get to our listeners. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at phone numbers 1-888-477-9499. Before I get to our listeners, let me ask you something, though, Tim. I mean, even if he has this sort of chaotic management style and, you know, is easily manipulated and conned, it seems to me that the NRA, at least under Wayne LaPierre, has been highly successful. There are more guns in this country than there are people. We have, you know, many more lax gun laws here in the state or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I should say. Governor Wolf just vetoed a controversial gun law that would have enabled residents to carry concealed weapons without a permit. It's actually an issue before the U.S. Supreme Court. So it has been highly effective, has it not?
Well, yeah, it's a really complicated story to tell, right? Because on the one hand, the NRA as an organization is in shambles at this particular moment. Financially, it's in shambles. From a legal perspective, it's under real threat. But over the last few decades, its work and the trajectory it has put our gun politics on has been very powerful and very successful. That if you look now, I mean, we played some clips of the time in and around Columbine. You could argue that at the federal level, at least, it's easier to purchase a gun and obtain a firearm today than it was 20 years ago, despite all the mass shootings that have happened in that time period.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the last big push for gun control or gun safety legislation, which was championed by, you'll remember Senators Manchin and Toomey,
yeah.
That failed in 2013 after the Sandy Hook shootings, and that was something that the NRA had a part in.
Well, in fact, you write about that. I guess it was a lobbyist at the time was working with Toomey and Manchin. It ended up, coming face to face with a filibuster. Never went anywhere. And then the NRA lowered the ratings for Toomey and Manchin for their work, right?
Well, what's intriguing about that is that the NRA was actively involved in the negotiations for Manchin Toomey. Right. So there are several chapters in the book that take you behind those negotiations and kind of show you what happened behind the scenes through the eyes of an NRA lobbyist. And the NRA actually was an active participant in those negotiations, but ultimately pulled out at the last second and doomed the bill to failure.
Let me read some comments and questions. Tom says, are there factions within the NRA? Are they all just jostling to get as far to the right as possible? Is there no middle ground within the NRA?
You know, it's changed a lot. It's changed a lot over the last decade or so. In and around the time of Manchin Toomey, there were even NRA lobbyists who were interested in expanding background checks. I mean, the vast majority of firearms are transferred in this country, that requires background checks. So the idea of universal background checks is just a small change to that part of the process. But nowadays, you know, and particularly after Sandy Hook, the NRA has become much more absolutist. During the Obama era, it found a lot of benefit in terms of membership and fundraising to take a more extreme approach, and not just about guns. The NRA has become a kind of culture war organization that extends itself to all sorts of topics unrelated to firearms in particular. And it wants to brand itself as this organization standing between government and its members on all sorts of issues.
Although, interestingly, under Obama, that was a great way that the NRA used to sell guns, to say that Obama, which he never did, wanted to take your guns from you, and that's a great selling point.
Right. Well, so it was very successful. The NRA was very successful during the Obama era. Gets fat on fundraising and increased membership. And the irony is that it kind of all falls apart in the Trump era. Now, the election of Donald Trump was one of the real primary goals of the NRA in 2016. It spent more money supporting Trump's election than even Trump's own super PAC.
It was $30 million, right?
More than 30, yeah. And the funny thing is, the ironic thing is that that actually does come to pass, but that's kind of marks the start of the end. That in a Trump administration, like so many Republican administrations, the NRA is not able to sell that fear to its members. And so membership goes down, fundraising goes off a cliff, and they have no strategic plan on how to deal with this. And in the wake of this problem, in the wake of this financial contraction, whistleblowers begin to emerge, reporters begin to start making progress, investigations get launched, and we find the NRA in real peril.
Let me just quote, and this was back to 1999. These are the NRA tapes that you got your hands on. And two leaders are sort of, again, trying to figure out how do we deal with this situation. Macra says, talking to Jim Baker, Jim, let me ask you a question. What's the industry going to do? Baker says, I think the industry will do whatever we ask them to do. So the industry works for the NRA? The NRA works for the industry?
Well, you know, among some critics of the NRA, there's this tendency to call it a shill of the gun industry and manufacturers. But what we see in these tapes is actually, you know, the industry is terrified to cross the NRA. That the NRA holds a great deal of power over the industry itself. And that the lines of authority are actually reversed, that the gun industry is in general terrified to cross the NRA.
Do you think that's still, we're almost up at a break here. Do you think that's still true, or is everything just so in flux now?
Well, I think you know, you talk to folks in the gun industry, and what you realize is that a negative review or a bad message from the NRA can be devastating to their sales. So they're deeply careful about whether to stand up to the NRA, for example.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Tim Mak. He is NPR's Washington investigative correspondent. He has spent the last 4 years digging into the National Rifle Association, the NRA, and we've been talking about his findings, and they're all in this new book. It's called Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA. And again, as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Tim Mak about the NRA. Let me read an email from Kurt. He says, as a former NRA member, I left the organization after reports of extravagant spending by the CEO and board members. I was disillusioned by the NRA, feeling that they were no longer pursuing their core mission to uphold the Second Amendment. To put it colloquially, the NRA shot themselves in the foot. To you, Tim, are there other people that have left the organization because they feel as if either there's mismanagement or they don't really speak for them as gun owners?
You know, I have heard from quite a number of those folks, and what the numbers show is that membership has declined over the last 5 years. That they're even among very kind of stringent Second Amendment advocates, there's this growing recognition that the NRA right now, with its mismanagement and the executives in charge, don't really represent their views. And there's a lot of frustration and feeling of betrayal about what the current leadership has been up to.
Well, in fact, and this predates Columbine. So this was, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing that killed, hundreds of people, including numbers of children who happened to have a daycare center within that building. After that bombing, and it was Wayne LaPierre, right, Tim, that sent out this letter talking about jackbooted government thugs?
Right. You know, in the week before the Oklahoma City bombing, the NRA and Wayne LaPierre sent out a fundraising letter calling the ATF and other government agencies jackbooted thugs, kind of busting down the door to seize your weapons. And after the Oklahoma City bombing, which of course affected federal officials, yeah, and the Wayne LaPierre did not apologize or did not step away from that sort of terminology, leading to an exodus of members, some 500,000 folks leaving the organization, including very prominently President George H.W. Bush at the time, who publicly renounced his NRA membership as a result of that messaging from the NRA.
jackbooted government thugs. And then he goes on to write, wearing Nazi bucket helmets and black stormtrooper uniforms to attack law-abiding citizens. I mean, that is such incendiary language.
Yeah, and something that the NRA did not step away from in the aftermath of this terrorist attack in Oklahoma City. And so there was a huge backlash for the NRA at that point.
Let me read another question. This is John, who's a gun owner. He says, in Tim's opinion, would it be possible for the NRA to discern ethical gun ownership from the unethical misuse that we see on the news? Will we ever see them differentiate between the safe ways to own a gun and the obviously sick and unacceptable killing of people with military-grade weapons? And, I mean, it should be said that most people who have guns in this country are law-abiding. You know, hopefully most of them have them in locks if they're keeping them at home, that these are responsible people. But nonetheless, we're a country awash with guns and dealing with, you know, one homicide by gun every, you know, seems like every moment.
Yeah, what's definitely true is that over the years, the NRA has drifted away from its kind of original and primary mission, that of gun safety. A lot of gun owners will know the NRA primarily through the gun safety classes it holds in many communities across this country. You know, if you look at the NRA's public disclosure forms, what you'll see over the last few years is a dramatic decrease in the percentage of their funds that they're spending on gun safety and shooting sports and things unrelated to or things most kind of prominently related to its what has historically been its core mission.
You had mentioned the response to the Sandy Hook shooting. This was in 2012. I do want to play what NRA Vice President CEO Wayne LaPierre said responding to Sandy Hook. This was the massacre, and it killed something like 20 elementary school children. 6 staff members were gunned down. This was in Newtown, Connecticut. And here's what Wayne LaPierre said.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Would you rather have your 911 call bring a good guy with a gun from a mile away or from a minute away?
And Tim Eck, you say that Chris Cox, a lobbyist at the time, he was watching this on television. First of all, I mean, that's just a horrifying response to what happened at Sandy Hook. But that Chris Cox feeling the same way, saying this is a disaster.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a chapter in my book, Misfire, about what it was like to inside of NRA headquarters in the time in and around Sandy Hook. And so we kind of take you inside the room of where Chris Cox, the NRA's top lobbyist, is watching this unfold. And there was this deep disconnect between executives at the time that the NRA's top lobbyist, who needs to go and explain the NRA's position before lawmakers, wasn't even aware of what the NRA's position was going to be after Sandy Hook. And of course, it turns out to be this very in-your-face, no-compromise position, which is that actually the proper response to Sandy Hook should be more guns in schools, which is what the NRA lands on. And this leads to a lot of dissension inside the organization, particularly from Chris Cox, who kind of lets an expletive come out and rushes out of the room. There were certainly folks at the NRA who felt this was not the wisest approach, but it is the approach that the NRA went with.
Does Wayne LaPierre ever have any sympathy for the true victims, you know, at Sandy Hook, or their families, or their friends, or the teachers in that building?
Not that I can tell, and I've had a lot of conversations about it. The predominant reaction that Wayne LaPierre has in the wake of these shootings is one of self-pity and anxiety and fear for himself. He worries about his own personal safety. He thinks that some harm will befall him. So he often goes into hiding after mass shootings. You know, in one case, he flies to the Bahamas and hides out on a private yacht as one way to avoid what he perceives to be the danger that comes after mass shootings. In another case, there was this strategy meeting after a major mass shooting in America, and all the officials show up in a conference room to find Wayne LaPierre hiding behind a curtain because he's kind of used that curtain to kind of block out all external stimulus and is trying to comfort himself in the wake of all this pressure. He's a very strange person, as you can start to tell.
Absolutely. The Washington Post looked at the numbers of school shootings since Columbine, where so much of your book takes place, and it's, I believe, at 298 schools in this country have had to contend with school shootings on their grounds, just to underscore what you're saying. And I do want to talk about the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. This is, of course, a couple of years ago. This happens in Florida, but it also inspires, if I can put it that way, students to basically, you know, take to the streets to march for our lives. They have a huge rally in Washington, D.C. How does the NRA deal with that? And do they know how to deal with students who are so enraged and so bent on taking on the organization?
Well, the NRA, in the wake of some of these marches, posted a photo of the very firearm that was used at the Parkland shooting, and so they've had a very kind of in your face response. And this has been a real issue for the NRA internally, right? That there are always different factions inside the organization, but the ones that have won out over the last decade have been kind of messaging and fundraising people who have found it to be in their benefit to be as incendiary as possible, and that's what drives money to the organization.
And what kind of money are we talking about? I think you write that in 2020 they raised $284 million. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, this is hundreds of millions of dollars, and this is an organization that's really poorly equipped to be able to responsibly manage and oversee an organization of this size. One thing we haven't talked about is the massive size of the NRA's board, which is 76 members. Some board member has described it kind of like a Politburo, right? That it's just a total mess. So this is a panel that's supposed to oversee the appropriate and legal spending of all these hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's made up of, you know, kind of gun celebrities and people who have no background in accounting and finance and law. And so that's been one of the major reasons why the NRA has been accused of so much misconduct and mismanagement over the last years.
Let me read an email from Lou. I've been an NRA a life member since 1969. That being said, I'm also a social and fiscal liberal. I am delighted to hear that the NRA is on the ropes. So, I mean, it's interesting, Tim, and, you know, no one has a clear enough crystal ball to know about the future of the NRA. But as you write, this is an organization that is in deep trouble.
That's right. And I've heard from a lot of NRA members who have read the book and in particular are really interested in reforming the organization, changing the organization to be more responsive to its members. I think there are a lot of folks who feel betrayed on behalf of a lot of members across the country who are sending in $5, $10, $15 a month in what they're thinking would go towards their interests, but what ultimately goes towards these lavish meals and extravagant expenses that we've been talking about this hour.
And Letitia James, she's the Attorney General of New York. I mean, she wants to take this organization down.
That's right. The New York Attorney General's office launched an 18-month investigation that basically found tens of millions of dollars of misspending and misconduct, what they called fraud and abuse, and are arguing currently in court that the NRA is basically so corrupt that it can't exist as a nonprofit, and that the court should allow the New York Attorney General's office to dissolve the organization in its entirety. And so that's what I'm going to be watching very, very closely over the next year or so to see how that develops, because it's going to have such an important impact on the future of gun politics in this country.
Well, and sometimes we forget, or I forget, that it is a nonprofit.
Yeah, and in
since
fact,
it has so much money.
Well, we've talked about how it was formed after the Civil War. Well, it was formed in New York State, and that's why the New York Attorney General now has oversight authority over the National Rifle Association.
We focus a lot on the leadership, but to be sort of a regular worker at the NRA, what is that like?
Well, it's really interesting because there are really two tiers, right? For most people who work at the NRA, they work at a nonprofit, and so they make the kinds of sacrifices that you see nonprofit employees of all kinds make. You know, a lot of people work for nonprofits because they're passionate about the topic in question, and so they're willing to make less money in order to work on something they're really interested in and passionate about. And so what you really see at the NRA is a lot of employees working for, you know, for next to nothing, not realizing all the while that the executives of the organization are flying around on private jets and renting, you know, really expensive cars for their own use and pursuing these lavish vacations that we've been talking about.
What's been the response of the NRA to your reporting?
Well, it's interesting. They've tried to remain as silent as possible on the issue of the book. Of course, we have reached out to the NRA to discuss the contents of the book and to request comment for any sort of major development in the book.
Let me ask you about there's so many tentacles to this story, but the NRA's relationship with an organization called Angus McQueen. Help us understand that, Tim.
Yeah, so for many, many years, the NRA had this kind of symbiotic relationship with an advertising firm based out of Oklahoma called Ackerman McQueen, which was headed up by a man named Angus McQueen. We talked about the powerful people in and around the NRA who bullied Wayne LaPierre into getting what they wanted, and one of those people was Angus McQueen, who led the NRA's messaging for many, many years. The breakdown in the NRA is a very dramatic story of a power struggle between Angus McQueen and Wayne LaPierre, and actually Angus McQueen's son-in-law, who gets hired on as a lawyer at the NRA and then tries to push his own father-in-law out of the business.
Wow.
And that's kind of a major dramatic element in this book.
Well, and there's also this, you can explain this, but it involves a favored restaurant and how bills were paid and then, I guess, what, recycled through the NRA? Can you flesh that out for us, Tim?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked a little bit about lavish meals and executives and top officials at the NRA were able to hide their expenses from even their staff by using Ackerman McQueen, this advertising firm, as a pass-through. So they really like this Italian restaurant in Alexandria, Virginia, called Landini's. It's very expensive and very kind of top-line restaurant. But rather than bill it to the NRA, what they would do was they would slap their Ackerman McQueen credit card down. And Ackerman McQueen would take care of the bill and then bill that back to the NRA. So among NRA staff, it would look like Ackerman McQueen, the advertising firm, was just billing the NRA for services or something generic, servicing their client, right? But it was in this way, this kind of almost laundering of the expense, that the NRA's top officials were able to get lavish meals and thousands of dollars in makeup and stylist expenses for Susan LaPierre and many other expenses over the years for top executives at the NRA.
Wow. Tim Mack, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And he is NPR's Washington investigative correspondent, author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Here's an email from Elaine. The NRA is locked into a strategy of battling any gun legislation because any concession is the new receded starting line for the next fight. I can't stand that the bad guy, good guy with the gun philosophy, not always possible to distinguish between the two. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us at WHYY Radio Times on Instagram and Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.